Welcome back to Phantom Island, presented by Homefield. It's me, Ryan Nanny. Hi, we are on the other side of football season now. The Super Bowl is done. National championship, long gone. Surely there's nothing left for Phantom Island to possibly talk about. Ha ha! Wrong. First of all, there will still be football content in this feed. You're getting some today, in fact. And if you're a paid subscriber at Phantom Island, you'll get at least part of some on Friday. When me and Stephen Godfrey talk about All-Star games, including the Pro Bowl. But that's not all we do, obviously, here on the show. We talk about basketball. We talk about hockey. We talk about volleyball. We talk about the Olympics. We talk about kind of whatever is interesting to us and whatever we have burning questions to break down. So you should stick around because there's going to be a lot of fun stuff this off-season for us on this here feed. And if you want to sign up to hear all of it, of course, you go to phantomisland.show, sign up for a paid membership that gets you access to everything we do, the ability to submit questions to shows like The Single Wing, to suggest show ideas, which, spoiler, we are starting to look through those, and I think we're going to do a couple. And most importantly, you're supporting the work that we do, and we really appreciate it. I don't know if you've noticed, it is a rough time to be in media. We've made good choices with our careers. You know, at least Steven was always on this path, but I could have gone a different way. I did go a different way. And I decided, hey, that looks like a safe place to build a house. That swamp right there. Whoops. My bad, Mom and Dad. All right. We're going to work through my trauma on this episode in a very specific way. Not my career, but the career of Philadelphia Eagles and their offensive line coach or their previous offensive line coach. Before we do, it is, of course, time to talk to you about our friends at Homefield Apparel. I was driving with my oldest, who's 9, the other day, dead of winter. She looked out the window and was just like, ugh, it's so gray. It's so colorless out there. And she was right. Like, Tennessee can be a beautiful place of green and verdant landscape when it's not late January, early February. But then I looked down and I was like, hey, I've got all the color you need right here. And why was that? Well, it's because I was wearing something from Homefield Apparel. In this case, a green and orange Colorado State crew neck. And I thought about, like, you can really just bring the whole dang rainbow to your life thanks to Homefield Apparel. So I've gone and looked through some of the options to give you a sense of like how exactly you can do this without even necessarily going to some of the obvious choices. So for red, there's Indiana, of course, but I want to tell you there are some very strong offerings for Boston University, especially if you like dogs with hockey sticks. There's a Rutgers design that feels very much like a 1980s pizza and sandwich shop that might be a front for the mob. And my God, the red in some of these Utah options, you got to be kidding me. Orange, you are spoiled for choice with orange, but I will tell you, the sleeper hit that I think you should pay attention to, like, yes, Florida's here, Texas is here, Tennessee, Oregon State, Oklahoma State, Clemson, like, I get it, lots of choices, Syracuse, but the sleeper, go look at the UTSA collection at Homefield. Like, these are some great vintage logos on shirts, on crew necks, hoodies, you name it. UTSA is my sleeper pick for your orange. Yellow. I'm going with kind of a theme here. I'm picking App State, West Virginia, and North Dakota State. And I think the very first item I ever acquired from Homefield was a North Dakota State yellow t-shirt with a green bison on it, which you can still get and is still available. And I like that the yellow choices I've gone with are all very much like, hey, man, let's just escape to the country, to the wilds. We don't need city life anymore. We don't need the trappings of, we don't need podcast. I mean, you do. Please listen to podcasts. Don't abandon the podcasts. Green. Eastern Michigan green is just beautiful. Just wonderful. Similarly, Ohio has some wonderful green choices. And you can get a North Texas bomber jacket that says Mean Green on the back. Like, talk about being on theme with that one. Again, like, So many good greens you can go with at home field. Blue. I really like the bright, crisp Air Force blue. There's one item at homefieldapparel.com, which is it's a t-shirt for the U.S. Air Force parachute team. That rules. It's got an eagle holding lightning bolts in its talons. That rules. You can check out the Colorado School of Mines collection, which some of which has Blaster the Burrow. Sometimes Blaster is blue as well. And then if you're looking for something a little closer to home and you're in Tennessee, which maybe you're not, Memphis, just go to the Memphis stuff. Like, really good blue options for you there. Okay, that brings us to indigo and violet. I'm just going to lump those together because I'm going to be honest, I'm not confident that I could say, like, yes, this is indigo and this one is violet. So these are the purple families. There are some really good lavender options within the Kansas State collection. I know you're thinking Kansas State. I already know that they're purple. And the like traditional purples of Kansas State are there. They look great. I'm not discounting them. But if you're looking for something in the lavender household, that's what you call it, right? I'm really good at this. Kansas State has a lot of good choices for you there. I really do like the deep, deep purple, that like rich purple of Eastern Carolina, ECU. And Stephen F. Austin, you can buy from home field a Stephen F. Austin shirt that has a squirrel holding an axe. Why did that squirrel get the axe? I don't know. It's not for me to know. Some mysteries are better left unsolved. But that's not what we're here to do. We're here to talk to Mike Golic Jr. You know him. You love him. And we're here to answer one simple question. What does it take to be a good offensive line coach?
Every rustle in the trees, a potential snare. Close my eyes and block my ears. Cut the cord and leave me here.
Jeff Stoutland left the Philadelphia Eagles, and Philadelphia Eagles fans responded with their usual amount of online calm and gentleness. No, they all freaked out. He'd been the offensive line coach for 14 seasons. He'd run a ton of good offensive lines. And of course, every story that came out after that was about how the Eagles internally were a mess, because that's the only thing you can do when you talk about the Philadelphia Eagles unless they win the Super Bowl. So this all led me to a bigger sort of question, which is, what makes an offensive line coach good or bad? To do that, I have brought on Mike Golic Jr., the co-host of Golic and Golic on the FanDuel Sports Network, and with our friend Jess Montana, The Echoes, a podcast about all things Notre Dame. But I'm not bringing you on because you're a sparkling audio personality, though you are. I'm bringing you on because you belong to this club. You belong to the Offensive Lineman Club.
It's a beautiful club, and just for that reason, I brought my bona fides here on the shirt repping for the Joe Moore Award, for people that don't know, that goes to the best offensive line unit in college football. So I tried to lean into my bona fides in this area, which, you know, despite not playing in the NFL, I managed to rack up a lot of O-line coach experience in college, where I had four different offensive line coaches in 5 years at Notre Dame, which I don't recommend. You shouldn't do, and it's not usually a great sign, but it happened, so here we are.
Okay, that was in my notes, and so thank you for confirming that was in fact the number. So let's just start there. When you have a new offensive line coach come in, how jarring necessarily is that transition? Like, I think the archetype we think of is new offensive coordinator comes in. He has his own system. He sometimes, you know, has his own terminology. Everybody sort of like got to get on the same page. To what degree is it like when you get a new offensive line coach, you are starting from scratch and you are starting from the beginning and learning what they want to do the way they want to do it?
Very similar. And like I would say to people, like, each offensive line coach kind of comes from a tree or a system, the same way we think about with coordinators. And it's sort of similar to what you hear guys in the NFL, whether you played, you know, a West Coast offense or anything like that. Conceptually, there's a lot of things that, you know, show up in different places. And relatively speaking, for a line play, the job is move a guy from point A to point B in the run game and then stay between the guy and the quarterback in the pass game. But off that, technically how these guys like to do it, the things they teach all the way from your stance and how that's going to be a part of the offense, the splits that you use, how far apart you are from each other, and then like the nitty gritty technical aspects of it. And just sometimes the approach overall, the philosophy of how they see the position and how it fits in the offense, all those things can be different based off, you know, what tree of offensive line coach you came from under and who you learned from in particular. And so every spring I went into with a new offensive line coach, you know, your goal, and especially for me as a young guy who was trying to earn playing time for the majority of my career until the last two, it was, what is this coach asking of me specifically? And how much am I going to need to change or rewire from what I've already learned? What's transferable and what's not based on what they want? Because, yeah, you fit into the larger scheme of the offense, but he's going to control your playing time. So I got to kind of meet this guy and give him what he wants to an extent.
So looking back on your college career, having had four different offensive line coaches, what would you say, like, you really learned, or where are the areas where you grew as a lineman from either one of these in particular, or just sort of the experience as a whole? Like, what was the impact of having college level of offensive line coaching for you?
Well, I think in terms of like the big picture, like, you learn how to learn pretty well. You learn how to quickly take in what someone else is teaching you, try and apply that, and, you know, add it to your game. And, you know, in college, it's different. It's more of a big box approach because there's a lot of you and you're still in this like different portion of your football journey. Whereas like for some veteran guys in the offensive line, it's like this, but mostly in the NFL, that's where you start to realize my body's different, my skill set's different, and so I've got to tailor it to this. But, you know, college, it's more of a football 101 approach to that. Like, so I learned that in general and probably took something from each of them. I would say the most instructive for me in like how my worldview for the offensive line is, how I see and judge the position, where I grew the most as a player, was my last, you know, year at Notre Dame. I played for Harry Hiestand, who in my mind is the greatest modern offensive line coach in college football. Like, you go back and look. So he was the guy that prior to that had coached guys like Dave Deal at Illinois, had put a bunch of guys into the NFL at Tennessee, had two stints with the Chicago Bears, including with Olin Krutz and a lot of those great guys in the early 2000s, and then got to Notre Dame and the run of guys he went on there from, you know, my teammate Zach Martin, who was a first round draft pick, Mike McGlinchey, Ronnie Stanley, Quentin Nelson, like on and on. That wave was all Harry Hiestand guys. And he was the one that to me had like the most holistic approach, because with some offensive line coaches, with a lot of coaches in football, some of them have upward trajectory in mind. Mm-hmm. Like, some of these guys are here and they really want to be a coordinator. They'd rather call plays. They'd really want to ascend the ladder. And you can kind of tell Harry Hiestand wanted to do nothing but coach the offensive line. and that's like, that's why when the Stoutland stuff came out, like, that kind of really hit a chord, because you mentioned 14 seasons. Like, this was not someone with grand ambitions. So it starts there. Like, he is dedicated to that room. And the first meeting we have with Coach Hiestand is, there is a pride and a standard in the Notre Dame offensive line room that we are going to make sure that we live up to. There are guys that came before you that are going to watch the way that we play football, and we have to give them something that they can be proud of and look at there. And so right off the bat, like, you can tell it's deeply, everything about it is deeply personal to him, because it's a reflection of that room. And really, our tape is a reflection of him. And you felt that in the way that he coached. And I think from that foundation on, that was really the most like jarring, where I realized like, okay, this is a great opportunity. And kind of like I said to someone talking in the NFL about like Mike McDonald comes over from Baltimore to Seattle. And if you're a guy in that defense, you know, he made that defense into a war machine. He coaches dudes. And if you buy in, the results are there. We all kind of knew when Harry came in, hey, we've seen what he's done at past stops. And so if we buy into everything that he's talking about, this is what's possible for us as a group. This is what's possible for us as individuals. You know, Joe Moore was one of his mentors. And so that through line there kind of gave you a sense of like, all right, these are deeply rooted ideas in how we're going to go and play offensive line at this school. And it really like got the best out of me as a player, his approach, and it, to me, got the best out of our group and certainly informed now the way that I see and think about the position.
Do you think what made his approach so different to you and your teammates was what he was asking of you physically or mentally, if you had to sort of pick one?
Boy, they both went so hand in hand. Like I always tell people, 2012, we went undefeated the season that Coach Hiestand came and joined the offensive line. It was far and away the best on paper season I ever had. And it was a terrifying ball of anxiety every single day. Like, it's why I have like even more respect in hindsight for what the like Saban era Alabama guys did. Because when I used to hear, you know, Lewis Riddick talk about Coach Saban as a coach when he was in Cleveland, or the guys that came out of Alabama, it's the same stuff. It's this like unrelenting standard. And I think, like, you know, to the larger point of this conversation, the best offensive line coaches, who I base it off, you know, the one I believe is the best I played for, it really is like, we're not going to do anything just to do it. Mm-hmm. Like, physically, the way he challenged us, like, we weren't going to do shoots. We weren't going to do a ton of things. Like, we were only going to do things that showed up on the field. So it was a lot of, like, us hitting each other, you having to be a great defender. He spent so much time coaching you on how to play defense for the guy in the drill, so you were going to get him the best look possible. And you'd get ripped up and down if you were loafing in that part of how you did this. We were out at practice a half hour, 40 minutes before everyone, and we were out there 40 minutes after everyone doing mirror dodge drills, like one-on-one pass blocking by ourselves after we had just done the full practice. Because physically, he said, we have to lead this team. We're the tip of the spear. We have to win because of us and the foundation that we set. But then it's also the mental portion of, one, you know, the incredible mental toughness it takes to go out there when you're sore as hell, maintain that level of focus. But then it was also like, hey, in the meeting rooms, it's the same thing. Like, we're not going to go past a rep if there's something to correct. The same way on the field, like, if we were doing a reach drive cutoff drill, just base drive blocking technique, you were going to go until you got it right. And you were going to go and finish 10 yards through the bag. It wasn't just through there. It was the echo of the whistle. And then when we got into the meeting room, if something was wrong, we'll clear out the tables and we'll figure it out. We're going to get through it. We'd get like there'd be meetings where you'd get through like five plays because there's so much to go through and so much to correct and make sure you get right on every one. And it was really like the mental part, because obviously all that physically sounds like a grind, but the mental part was, can I come in every day and attack it with that resolve? Can I bring that level of focus that's needed? Like, I learned what it took to win, going back to the Saban point, in a way that I had not been exposed to yet, and what that really requires of you every day. And it was jarring. It was at times miserable, but you saw the results once it started to happen, that's a necessary part of, especially when you go from a team at the time that wasn't winning at that level to one that was. Those little building blocks on the day-to-days where the mental toughness kicked in is like, all right, what I did yesterday doesn't matter. I got to stack it with the next day or else all this is for shit.
It also occurs to me that the offensive line coach, I think, and I didn't play, so you can tell me I'm wrong here, has the job on the team of the position coaches where unit cohesion is the most consistent part of it. Obviously, that's true of every position coach, but like, depending on how you're calling a defense, you don't necessarily need your defensive backs to be fully aligned all the time on every play. Depending on what you're doing on offense, if you're the wide receivers coach, you're like, okay, there are plays where you are just window dressing or something here. But for the guys who are on the line, literally every snap, it's like, not only does this have to work on an individual level, if it doesn't work like as a group, it will all fall apart. And I'm curious, like, what do you think is the how do you sort of like make that work if you're a good offensive line coach and get the best, not just out of like, hey, you know, I turned Mike Golic Jr. into this like really effective starter for Notre Dame, but also like I made him part of a unit. I made him part of a group that could execute in synchronicity in a lot of ways.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. The one group I'll push back on there, because I've always maintained this take, defensive backs are just little offensive linemen with
one
flag.
Okay.
They are
okay.
It's a very, like I always said, defensive backs and offensive linemen have the unique distinction of an entirely learned skill set where you go back against some backwards
sure.
and try and defense the best athletes in the world. But like none of what you do, you come out of the cradle doing. Mm-hmm. And so it's all a learned skill set. So shout out to the Dominique Foxworth of the world, my DB brethren in arms. But no, it's that was the other part of what Coach Hiestand brought that I think was so impactful. It was a running joke. You never saw any of our offensive linemen alone. everywhere we went, whether it was the weight room, going out to pre-practice, after practice, when we'd all go and watch film by ourselves separate from him, everything had to be done as a group because it didn't matter if I knew my job, if I didn't know how it affected, I played right guard, how it affected the right tackle, how I had to communicate through things with the center, because as a group, you've got that responsibility. Like I always said, O-line's an incredibly accountable position because if I'm an inch off on my land bark, my buddy who's the running back gets his shit rocked in the backfield and, you know, could end his career, could end his day, could just end the play. But that's kind of the level of anxiety you have to carry into that. And so it really was like, and that was a mandate from him, is you guys are going to go out to practice as a group. You guys are going to leave practice as a group. I want to see you guys eating together. We hung out together after practice. And, you know, we had a great group that was super close. We had guys that had been there a long time. And so that in some ways came naturally, but he made us more aware of it. And it, I think, had a direct impact. Like I always tell the story, every Friday night going into Saturday when we'd be at the hotel, he would give us our offensive line test. So here's the plays on the docket for the week. Here's the looks that we think we're going to get. You go through, draw them up, answer questions about, you know, how we were going to ID things, how we were going to adjust to certain things. And we would all just pile into one of our rooms and we would take the test together. Because again, it didn't matter if I could answer the questions. It mattered if we could problem solve through this and how we all saw that going into it. So I think that's one of the most important parts of the development of that unit is, you're right, it really has to be a unit. Like offensive line to me is the art of knowing when to give and receive help, because you rarely are you going to do it alone. You, we were lucky we had Zach Martin, who you could put an island with somebody and, you know, slide protection my way because I need a little more help. But in general, like, no, everything requires you to know your buddy really, really well.
So now when you are not playing and you're just watching a game, whether it's for work or just, you know, casually, what do you look for during a game to sort of tell you, like, oh, this is a well-coached offensive line? Like, what are sort of the indicators that somebody like me could copy off of your paper and be like, oh, okay, I can see that now, and that tells me something about, like, how this unit is being run?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And, like, you know, watching tape all the time for the award, like, you're trying to figure out, because I don't know what a lot of these coaches ask of their guys specifically, but you know, to me, you can always tell, like, when I turn on a rep and I see the left guard and the right, or the left guard and the right tackle doing the exact same thing, like, oh, they both slid to the same spot. They carried their hands in the same place. When a guy tried to go inside of them, they both punched the same spot here. Like, whether it happens, it would, you know, with any sort of like synchronicity, or it's just, you can see like consistently displayed technique tells me, one, your coach, you know, sets the expectation. Like, we knew how to do everything we were supposed to do. Like, even now, like, I could tell you the basic tenets of, like, how we went about base blocking and how we coached that. And so when you turn on the tape, you'd see our, you know, me doing that, Zach doing that, Chris Watt, our left guard, doing that. So if you see, like, consistent footwork, like, oh, all these guys kind of take the steps that look the same and all that. And then I think the other thing is, like, a lack of space. Like, to me, part of the timing on things is when you see double teams, when you see guys working together, if they're pushing against each other, if you can see the defensive lineman between them, like, that's an execution error to me. It's no disrespect to the D lineman, but the world I see it through is, hey, if we execute the right way, we can make sure life is pretty difficult for them. And so, you know, that lack of space, when you see two guys tight together that are able to drive a guy off the ball, when you see guys that the timing where they work from the D lineman to the second level, like, it's hard to see on the TV copy, quite honestly, if you're watching at home and you're seeing it that way. Usually my rule of thumb is, hey, if more often than not you see a lack of color coming through the line of scrimmage in general, they're moving forward, like, that's a pretty good, well-coached group. But I think I always called it, like, tight. Like, I don't want to see a loose offensive line. I don't want to see a ton of space. I want to see a group that lines up with purpose on every play. And if you see those things consistently replicated, you're usually looking at a pretty good group.
To your understanding, what do you think are the major differences for this job at the college level versus coaching professional offensive linemen?
Yeah, no, that was, you know, something we kind of asked Coach about a lot, because he had coached those great guys in the Bears, and, you know, he comes in and it's, you know, his way or the highway to an extent. Like, again, different strokes for different folks. Zach Martin was already a really good player. Coach Heisan understood, I want to add to, not in place of. For some of the rest of us, myself included, you kind of had to rewire some things in general, and so there's a lot more of that that goes on and, you know, how you can go about doing that, how hard you can be on guys versus at the NFL level. If you're coaching, you know, 8, 9, 10 year vets, you're still coaching them hard. You're still coaching the same technique, but at times it's a little bit more of a conversation if, hey, your starting center's had 3 knee surgeries and can't do this exactly, or he, in another lifetime with a coach he's had for 4 or 5 years, has figured out things that work specifically for him. Like, there's still the standard in the room and going out there and holding everyone accountable. Like, the best players all want to be coached. That stuff's there. But I do think the NFL at times can be a little bit more of like a bespoke operation, and certainly more of a conversation like it is in almost every position, because, you know, you got your 10,000 hours and then some. By the time you're a, you know, 4, 5, 6 year veteran, you've played a ton of football, way more than you did at the college level. You're an adult who does this to feed your family. So you're kind of given, at least from what I saw, again, my cup of coffee in the NFL was like a sniff, but I got a chance to know a lot of guys and, you know, see a lot of guys work at a really high level. And that was always what stuck out to me, was they had so much shared experience that it could be a little bit more collaborative in how you went about it, versus in college, it's dictated to you. You're still learning. You're still trying to build that foundation that eventually gets you there.
One of the things that I think when we're talking about offensive line in college transitioning into the NFL, I don't know, I feel like we're on year, call it 10, of everybody saying, college isn't churning out good offensive linemen. Like, they're doing a bad job of developing this position, and that's leaking into the NFL. And I'm just curious, as someone who played the position in college, had some experience at the pro level, like we talked about, and sort of, you know, does this evaluation for the Joe Moore Award, for other parts of your work, like, how much truth do you think there is to the idea that college football doesn't develop offensive linemen as well as it could or should or used to?
I think there's some credence to it, like, especially now, like, this is a position that I was really fascinated to see how the portal would affect and how teams would adjust to that. Because on one hand, having an offensive lineman, a really good one, who's a prospective free agent every year, that's a coup. Finding great offensive linemen in college with all the, you know, difficulties we know is really hard. So those guys can be really valuable. But going back to the cohesiveness point, if you're bringing in a bunch of guys and then trying to get them to gel in a limited amount of time, because in college you've got comparatively less hours on the field than the NFL, where, you know, you also post, like, 2011 when they changed the practice hours in the collective bargaining agreement, like, everyone's got less time for the position that, like I said, is the most unnatural. So that does affect everyone and their ability to do that. And it's why college development is so important to the NFL, because you do have a lot less time. But I always thought it's, to me, the thing that in my mind is the biggest net negative on this is how quick we are to pull the ripcord on coaching staffs, because it makes you coach from a place of fear where, all right, I have less time with these guys. I'm trying to get them to fit in with the larger context of the offense. And I also don't want to get fired. And so what am I going to do? I'm going to go and coach looks. I'm going to say, hey, going into a game, I'm going to show you everything that we could possibly see. And we'll spend some time on the technical aspect of it, but I want to make sure I can cover my ass. And again, like, I say that and it sounds negative. In some cases it is, but I think a lot of cases, like, self-preservation drives us all. And it goes against what I think is in the best interest of the player. And it's what I was fortunate to get with Coach Hiestand, is he always was big on, I'm going to give you the tools of how to play this position the right way. You're going to know how to pass off stunts and games and twists, no matter where they come from. You know what's expected of us on a drive block, no matter what the defender does and how to adjust if he moves post-snap. You know how you're supposed to set on every technique you could possibly get in front of you on a pass set. So eventually, when you get to those a few looks in a game, because these defensive coordinators are good, that we couldn't possibly prepare for, when something off the wall happens, you're going to have the tools to problem solve that yourself. Yes, we're going to demand you do things a certain way, but we're also going to empower you so that when you get into a situation where the shit hits the fan, you have things to fall back on that you can go to, and not just trying to work through a Rolodex of, well, man, if I didn't see this, what the hell am I supposed to do? You've got principles to go on. And I wonder if at times the way the whole ecosystem works now maybe makes people coach a little bit more out of, you know, fear might be the wrong word, but out of a desire to just be ready for all these things, because there's so much at stake each and every week when it comes to your ability to feed your family, versus going out there and drilling the things that actually work and actually getting it done, job status be damned.
Doing the things that sort of are like, this may lead to a bumpier first month, but by the time we get to November, all of this work is going to pay off in a way that, like, well, whatever I prepped you for in week two, we don't play them again. So we don't get to, like, that's not useful right. to you anymore.
No, exactly. One, it's like I always said the way we were coached, like, we were a big, you know, two-hand punch team. Like, we wanted to be aggressive in everything mm-hmm. that we did. It was running off the football on drive blocks, on, you know, it didn't matter if it was gap, if it was zone. Like, we were going to run off the line of scrimmage, and we were going to create contact, create space, get our backside arm and backside leg into guys, run them off the ball. Like, that was how we were going to operate. In the pass protection game, we were going to get hands on guys, and we were going to physically jolt them. We wanted to turn them into a Pez dispenser. And sometimes that means you're going to swing and miss, and you're going to get out of position. There's a little bit more risk involved with that. And so it takes, like, again, courage is too much a word, but, like,
confidence. It definitely takes confidence, for sure.
It takes confidence to go out there and swing big like that and do the things you're taught to do, even if occasionally you're going to miss, versus, you know, you could play with shittier technique and you could get in the way and kind of make sure that guys, you know, may leak off you late, but that's not the right way to do things. And eventually that's going to get you got, just trying to play not to lose, as opposed to trying to go out there and dictate the terms to people.
So then when a lot of, I think, my understanding about good offensive line coaching really has to do with everything that happens before kickoff. During a game, what is a good offensive line coach doing to sort of, like, keep everybody on the same page? Like, what does their sort of day look like once we actually put toe to leather?
Yeah, problem solving. Like, that was the biggest thing is, and I always said that was, like, the most important part of spring ball for us. And going through the machinations of the spring game, like, as much as I hated spring ball, and I think most guys do, when you got a new coach, you got to learn how they communicate and problem solve on game day and how we're all going to see this. It's different now because of the tablets. Like, now that you have that on the sideline, it's been a coup for these staffs, and you actually have the video. But what we used to have to do, like, you know, anyone who was a backup would be with coach, and you'd be at the best angle that you could to see the line. And he would have the notepad out, and he'd be going through every play. He'd get the call, he'd write it down, and he'd write down the results. And then we'd come back over to the sideline after every series, and we would double check with each other. What did we get? How did they respond to this look? Was it different than what we expected? And if so, is there something we need to tweak? Is there just a point we need to reinforce in coaching that one of us messed up on? And how do we go about that? And so, again, I'm sure with the tablet now it makes that easier, but you're usually over there with the notepad, the whiteboard, everyone's huddled up there. And our big thing was, it doesn't matter what the defense does. Like, you were never up watching the defense in the middle of a drive. It was, we're over there, we're catching our breath, we're getting hydrated, and we're talking to each other to make sure that we've got that. Like, so the coach would do that. He'd come over, he'd have first run at it. Then, you know, usually your backup would kind of have eyes on you and come over and have that same conversation and just, you know, talk about things from that vantage point. So it really is, from that point on, like, you have to be a good problem solver all day on game day, and that relationship and how you guys honestly communicate through that becomes the most important part.
It also strikes me that part of what goes into being a good coach at this position is being able to delegate that onto the field to a large extent, because you don't, like, there's one person with the radio in their helmet, and it's not an offensive lineman. And there is a lot of diagnosis that needs to happen pre-snap, a lot of communication that needs to happen. So, like, what is that process like by which sort of the line figures out how they're going to communicate with each other? And also sort of, like, how do you figure out, how does the coach figure out sort of, like, okay, here is how I'm going to trust you guys to be able to make these decisions when I can't be here telling you, like, this is what we're going to do and this is how we're going to do it?
Yeah, no, that's where all the reps and hours come into play. Like, you know, we said our job was to see everything through one set of eyes. Mm-hmm. So everyone, that's where it comes back to, like, doing the test together, all that stuff. Like, some of the nuts and bolts of that comes down to, like, you know, what's your quarterback situation like? Are you a more veteran line or a more veteran quarterback? So, you know, if you've got, like, the Tom Brady's, the Drew Brees of the world, like, they're going to have final say on who we're all blocking. Like, yep. You know, setting the protection is, like I always say, it's basically who's the center blocking. And then off of that, it tells you, all right, if we say the Mike is the linebacker on that side, like the Mike, the zero, were all the terms that we use, that's just basically who the center is going to more often than not in protection. And so it tells us where we're going. It tells the running back where we're going. Then everything else is just, really like it's the part that would be hardest for a coach to help, because everything else is based on timing and angles. Mm-hmm. So on each play, you have your assignment more or less of this is where we want the play to go, on outside zone, on a power gap run, on an inside zone. We know where the ball is supposed to go. We know the general timing of it. And so now for us up front, it's all right, where are the down linemen? Because you want to take care of the first level first. They're the closest to the action. They're the ones that can blow this thing up the quickest. And then from there, it's all right, where is he? And where's the linebacker that usually me and a buddy are working towards? Like everyone's kind of working in combination when the plays go the best. And based on that timing, that's where your call comes into play of, all right, based on where that linebacker is, am I working with the guy to the right of me or to the left of me? And like, you know, examples of that, like on the front side of zone plays, it would be if the center and the left guard are working together, we call that single. Guard and left tackle working together, double, triple. And on the backside, it was A, B, and C for all that same stuff. And so you're kind of going up there, and usually there's like the center tends to get a lot of that because he's got the best vantage point kind of on a lot of the angles. But when you got a veteran group, sometimes those guys in their pod can take care of each other, but you got to have that conversation quick. Like that's why I always hated tempo, because you didn't get a clear look at what was going on. You just got to kind of go up there and hope, which I hated. But when you get a clear look at it like that, it's all right, let's all take a quick look at this. We understand what we think we're going to get based on formation and everything. Did it change? This is where we're going to, and then let's try and go out here and whoop these guys' ass.
One of the interesting things about, I think, the Stoutland story in particular, but it sort of made me think about the role this position coach plays within the offense as a whole, is there's this overlap with the offensive coordinator and the quarterback, and I want to start to get into all of that, but I want to start with the most sort of like hybrid position. How does the offensive line coach work with tight ends and tight end coaches? Because this, depending on the system you're running and the kind of guys you have, sometimes these guys are basically an additional offensive lineman, and sometimes they're basically an additional wide receiver, and sometimes there's something in between. So like, how does that sort of overlap work?
Yeah, usually it's just, you know, defined practice periods where you know you're going to be working with them. So, you know, you'd start off the day going through practice. Like we would start with reach, drive, cutoff, and just do our base block stuff, working out of our stance, firing off. And then pretty early on in practice, like usually the cadence of practice, like you have individual drills for a while. You'd probably throw like inside run 9-on-7 in there for a little bit and just get the run heavy portion of it, especially early in the week. And then you would have the passing stuff. So you do one-on-one pass protection and then team at the end of practice. And so usually the tight ends would come over and do some sort of like work on combination blocks with you before you'd get to the inside run period that they'd be a part of there. And so they'd come down, and for that period, they're basically offensive linemen. Like the tight end coach is there. The offensive line and the tight end coach kind of have an understanding of how things are going to work. I think in most cases, and I, you know, can't speak to this specifically, but I would imagine there's a little more deference in terms of what the offensive line coach wants out of the way that we're going to approach run blocking with this group. Because if you're the tight end, you've got to know our rules for this. You've got it. Like we've all got to be on the same page of, hey, if the tackle and tight end are working together on the backside, on the play side, on a gap scheme, on a zone scheme, like we all have to know that same stuff. So they get a good chunk of time with you pretty early in practice to come down and work through all that.
And then how, you know, again, with Stoutland, a lot of it sort of came down to the Eagles last year weren't involving him in run game coordination in the way that he wanted to. And that's a thing I sort of like hadn't even put together, is like, yeah, I'm sure the offensive line coach does have a lot of thoughts about like what we should be doing in the run game and how like his unit factors into it. But like, what do you think is the usual or best practice for the offensive line coach to work with the quarterback and sort of say like, here is what, you know, here is how we work together, my unit and you, to work with the offensive coordinator? Like, how do you sort of take it from, I have this unit that I run super well that has this highly specialized job, and how do you sort of integrate it into everything else that the position, the skill players are doing, and make it all, like, how do you make it all work, I guess is my question.
Yeah, this part's the most interesting to me, because like it's the part I have the least experience with, because sure, I never coached, I never had to work through that. But like in my head, it always made sense, because who's going to know what we're capable of as an offensive line better than the offensive line coach? Like, hey, you know, Pittsburgh Steelers in the early 2000s, we have one of the most athletic centers in football in Marquise Pouncey. let's get him on the move. Let's pull him. Let's run a bunch of outs. Like, let's take advantage of the fact. Jason Kelce in Philadelphia, same thing. Like, hey, you've got one of the greatest athletes at that position we've ever seen. Let's get him out on the move. Let's do this stuff. Our guys are comfortable executing that at a really high level, and we think we could have a decided advantage with that. And so that was always my thought process of why that would work so well in that role. And with Jeff Stoutland, because he had been there so long, because he had had so much success with those guys, like, who is going to know better than him, as you had a revolving door of coordinators in there, even just during the Sirianni years, even though Stoutland predates that, like, who's going to know what that group is capable of better than him? And so cluing him in on that conversation, like, from an X's and O's standpoint, just feels like it'd be beneficial because of that knowledge. But then I do think, like, this is also just about, like, a respect and human dynamics standpoint. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, the guy's been here 14 years. He's coached at least one Pro Bowler every year he's been on the line. Like, all these guys, the way they talk about him is a level of reverence that tells me, like, that's the dude. So at the very least, like, even if you're not going to take his words into account, like, I feel like looping him in is the bare minimum that you can do for, again, when you know you've got someone who is elite at what they do in an area that very few, like, staffs in the NFL do. Like, there aren't a lot of Jeff Stoutlands walking the earth at any time, let alone in the NFL at any given year. So why you wouldn't make sure that he feels a part of that process in something that clearly, again, he didn't have grand aspirations of being an offensive coordinator or a head coach, at least it seems like from the outside.
Right.
So this guy gives a shit at the highest level about the guys that he is coaching there. He's got so much time and equity in that room. Like, it didn't make a lot of sense to me the way reportedly that was handled. Maybe more comes out later. I always want that caveat, but
yeah, sure. And like, with Stoutland particularly, Kelce and Lane Johnson, I think you can look at and be like, look, these were like guys who probably were going to succeed wherever they went. And you know, like, there's always, I think with any coach, there's a question of like, is it you or is it the talent, whatever. But for Stoutland, I look at Jordan Mailata and I'm like, what you did taking this guy who came from a completely different background and not just turning him into an effective starter, but like, an all pro, a like elite level offensive line. Like, that to me is the story of like what you can do with a good offensive line coach. Is you can not only, you can't, it's not just about necessarily I used the talent we had on hand and I got everything out of them. It's I raised the bar for some of these guys and I made them better than they thought they could be. And like Mekhi Becton last year is another example of like, oh, this is what you can do with a really good coach at this position. I'm just working through some feelings as an Eagles fan, so we don't have to dwell on that.
It's spot on, though. And, like, I think it even goes a step further. Like, I always think of the movie Whiplash when it comes to this stuff because it's like, man, some of this stuff is going to be uncomfortable, but, like, it's also grounded, and this was true for Coach Hiestand, and by all accounts, when you hear Mailata, when you hear Kelce and all these guys talk about Stoutland, it was deeper than that. They know that this guy loved them and cared about them and truly wanted the best for them. Like, I've told this story before, but when I like, and that to me is, it makes all the other stuff possible. Like, you can get coached by a guy who's going to scream and dog cuss you up and down, but if you know, hey, this is coming from a place of this person truly wants what's best for me. Like, when I went to, you know, try and make my foray into pro football, I got cut by the Steelers as a rookie and I went back to South Bend to, like, you know, catch my breath, go work on some stuff, work out there. And my first stop was always Coach Hiestand's offense and office. And, like, you know, he, when I talked to him about it, he's like, go make a cut up of your pro day, every, you know, highlights you got from your last year and bring it over. And he hand wrote a note to every person he knew around the NFL to try, like, along with that, to try and help me out, to try and, you know, get me a shot in another camp here. Like, you were in it. Like, you were in it and you felt that most days, I thought. And it sounds like, you know, we hear Jordan Mailata say, he was like a second father to me. Like, I came over here in a place that was so foreign to me, doing a sport that was so foreign to me. And this guy was basically like another dad to me. He cared that much about that development. And, like, that's the other part. For some people, maybe that's just a job. For others, like, it's their life. And for Jeff Stoutland, it clearly seemed like, based on the way those guys talk about him, that was the case.
So I do want to point out something that is interesting to me about Jeff Stoutland and is interesting to me about this coaching position generally. Jeff Stoutland didn't play offensive line when he was a player. He was a linebacker. And I went through And 9 of the 32 NFL teams this past season had an offensive line coach who didn't play offensive line. I will say some of them were tight ends. We can argue about like whether that counts or not, but I didn't include, I didn't say like, yes, that counts as offensive line. And I looked at quarterback's coach and I looked at DB's coaches, and there are certain, you can find examples of guys who weren't quarterbacks but are a quarterback's coach or non-defensive backs. But like offensive line feels like there is more room for guys who didn't do this to come, like Indiana's offensive line coach in the national championship. He was a linebacker. Texas A&M's tight end. Texas Tech's was a like combo running back tight end. Is there a position that you think is naturally inclined on the offensive line to coach offensive line? And separately, why do you think there are so many guys who didn't play this position who can coach it effectively at the highest level?
That's the part I'm really like not sure of is, and maybe it's just like anything else. Like I think if you are passionate enough about something and curious enough about it, like we see this in modern football. And like, if we're just going to stay in our little world of football, like we see this in modern football analysis all the time. Like there are plenty of people and analysts that I love who do a phenomenal job, who never played a snap, but they're so curious and the give a shit level is so high that they can go out there and accomplish at a really high level. And that's kind of the same thing I think with an offensive line coach is, hey, as long as you're willing to go in here and dive all the way in and learn this incredibly like complicated golf swing for fat guys, then you can go and have success here. Now, it is interesting because, you know, there's always going to be a give and take in that. And like, I always think like, because to your point, position wise, generally, I would always say like center would probably be predisposed because in most offenses, that's the guy, you know, college, NFL, especially. They put a lot on those guys because you have that vantage point because it tends to be a position that lends itself well to that part of the game. But like one of the guys that I think is doing one of the best jobs in the league right now is Zach Strief, who was a right tackle for a long time for Sean Payton in New Orleans. And I had two off seasons there where I got to watch him and Jahri Evans, who were the right side of that offensive line for like a decade, work together. And, you know, just saw the game in that incredibly cerebral way where, you know, and a lot of times it's guys that weren't always the most physically gifted tend to work out well. Like my dad always tells great stories about being in the D-line room with Reggie White. And one day their D-line coach gave Reggie the period to try and teach them that hump move that Reggie always used to pull.
Yeah.
And my dad's like, we watched Reggie spin his tires for like a minute and a half because he said, I don't know how to coach it. I just know how to do it. He's a physical genius.
Right.
And his body could do things at, you know, 6'5", 300 pounds that the rest of them couldn't do size and speed wise. So he couldn't teach it. Whereas like my dad is someone who was, you know, by civilian standards, incredibly physically gifted, but he had to win in the margins. He had to win with technique. He had to be prepared for all that stuff. And so I think a lot of times the guys that are forced to see the game in that way, because their physical skill set is not, like their genius isn't there, it's got to be elsewhere. I think that makes you a candidate for coaching more often than not.
All right, you brought up your dad, so I'm going to ask the most personal question here. your dad played defensive line at Notre Dame. One of your uncles, I believe, played offensive line at Notre Dame. And the
Uncle
other one,
Greg, yeah.
Yes, yes. And your Uncle Bob was a defender as well. And I think if my research is right, your grandfather was an offensive lineman. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. And he played in the CFL.
That's right.
Did that. So, okay. Yeah.
So you grew up with like a well-known defensive lineman for a father. How did you end up on the offensive line side of things? Like when did that decision happen for you and what sort of motivated it?
Like I went to a really small Catholic high school in Central Connecticut. So like we played both ways. I played, you know, D end and D tackle in addition to playing offensive line, and like, you know, grew up in Pop Warner doing the same thing. But again, like I just think the personality type of an offensive lineman is very different. Like defensive lineman, it's go forward and destroy, like fast, aggressive, kill. I liked thinking through problems more. I liked the element of that existed in the offensive line world where it's, oh no, we've got to take a look at this, think about how we all fit together in the puzzle piece, and then go solve that problem and play the most violent chess match known to man. So I always just gravitated towards that. I always liked it better. I think naturally I was better at it than I was at the go forward and break stuff part of football. So that was more just like a very early on, I was like, oh, I this position and everything that comes with it was a lot more appealing to me than the other side of the ball on defense.
Do you think that colors like how you and your dad view line play? Like, because you come from this side of it and he comes from the other side of it, like, do you think like your window into the trenches is different and manifests in like a different way?
100%. I think like the way O-linemen and D-linemen see the world at times is different in that regard. Like, I went and saw Interstellar with my dad one night, and we walked out of that theater, and again, tale of two cities. I'm in the passenger seat researching all the stuff that they looked into about black holes and sure. How much of it was accurate. And I'm barfing these at him, and it's 11 o'clock at night on a Tuesday. And he's like, I don't give a shit. Like, my dad is self-professed a mile wide and an inch deep. He knows, he wants to know what the job is. He wants to go and accomplish that job. And then he wants to go back over on the sideline and have a break. He doesn't want to overcook any of it. So I think that O-line, D-line brain more often than not can manifest in a lot of ways, but yeah, no, it absolutely will also like color the way that we view all that. Cause I think all of us in our heart, like whatever side of the ball you were on, you see the success or failure of every play through that lens.
Yeah.
To me, it's like, you know, rarely is it, oh, that D lineman made a phenomenal play. It's more, well, this is what the offensive lineman did wrong there. This is where the set was bad. This is where his hands missed. Like, we can correct that and we can always get it blocked. Versus, you know, he sees that as a great rep or a great win for a defensive lineman.
All right, so here's what I'm going to get you out of here with. We're recording this a couple days after the Super Bowl that Seattle won over the New England Patriots. I'm not going to ask you about the Patriots side of the offensive line because I think there's going to be a lot of time for ink about that and a lot of big feelings about it. Seattle's offensive line, not particularly a hot topic of discussion, but I am curious from your perspective, what was your takeaway from what they did over the course of the game to contribute to Seattle taking home this Lombardi trophy?
Yeah, I think they stayed really confident even when some things didn't go their way. Like, you can look at the tape, plenty of wins for Anthony Jennings, Milton Williams, all the guys, Christian Barmore on the inside. Like, you know, Anthony Bradford at right guard had a tough time staying in front of a lot of those guys, but that didn't stop him from still going out and playing the position the way they were. One where I have a couple of reps saved on my phone where I was like, oh man, like they're going out here and executing at a high level. Like, they're passing off twists the same way on both sides. They're working through these things. Like, I can kind of see a window into what they're coached to do. And they just stayed consistent with that. They didn't let a mistake deter them on that front. They had a good plan, again, fitting into the larger context of the offense. Like, Clint Kubiak called a lot of really good hard sell play action stuff. They gave them plenty of opportunities with Kenneth Walker to get downhill and dictate the terms of this game. And they just kind of stayed at it and kept chipping away. I think that was one of those things that's really easy to say and really hard to do. Like, shit goes wrong, you get down on yourself. That next play mentality is hard for, you know, younger players to do, guys in college when you're a little bit more immature, but like professionals at the highest level, I thought those guys, you know, really stuck with it. They had a great fit in what Clint Kubiak wanted them to do. It was one of those last offseason where it's like, oh, this could work when you look and see what Clint was a part of last year with a different O-line in New Orleans before all the injury took hold. So I just thought they were remarkably consistent. And, you know, Gray Zabel was a rookie in the game, like Will Campbell and Jared Wilson on the other side, and had a lot of really good moments. And, you know, throughout the course of the season had some rookie ones, but they just seemed so consistent in their approach throughout the game.
All right, Mike, thank you again for joining me today. I don't know that I necessarily feel better about the Eagles going forward, but I do feel like you've helped me understand the question of what makes a good offensive line coach. And for that, I thank you very much.
Appreciate you giving me some time to wax poetic about some of the most important people on every football team. Thanks, buddy.
Phantom Island is produced by Michael Serber. Our theme song is also called Phantom Island from the album of the same name by King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard. Thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon.